When Steve Jobs confronted Bill Gates about stealing Apple's ideas for Windows in 1983, Gates delivered a devastating comeback. I think it's more like we both had this rich neighbor named Xerox, and I broke into his house to steal the TV set and found out that you had already stolen it. Indeed, the revolutionary Macintosh wasn't Apple's invention, but was reverse-engineered from Xerox's Alto computer. When Jobs visited Xerox PARC in 1979, he immediately recognized the potential of their graphical interface, while Xerox executives couldn't envision computers as household items. Jobs rushed back to Apple, determined to improve upon Xerox's design with a simpler mouse, artistic fonts, and a lower price point. This approach wasn't unusual in Silicon Valley, where reverse engineering drives innovation. Dell computers, Google Docs, and countless other technologies emerged through systematically examining existing products. Tech pioneers like Michael Dell, Larry Page, and Jeff Bezos all showed early tendencies to dismantle things to understand their workings. Despite Jobs' fury at Gates' betrayal, Microsoft Windows would eventually dominate the market, while Apple nearly collapsed, only surviving through a $150 million investment from Gates himself in 1997. The irony? The very practice Jobs condemned, reverse engineering, was exactly what had launched Apple's revolutionary products in the first place. We've traditionally been told two stories about greatness. It either comes from innate talent or from dedicated practice. But there's a crucial third path, reverse engineering, looking beyond what's evident on the surface to find hidden structures that reveal how something was designed and can be recreated. This approach has been used by countless icons across disciplines. The practice of copywork reveals decision-making patterns by forcing attention to organizational decisions and stylistic choices. Once a master's underlying code is broken, it can be defined, analyzed, and applied to creating original works. Beyond copywork, nonfiction writers examine endnotes to uncover source materials, while fiction writers have long analyzed successful patterns, from Aristotle's three-part structure to Kurt Vonnegut's six emotional arcs, Rags to Riches, Riches to Rags, Man in a Hole, Icarus, Cinderella, and Oedipus. Musicians openly reverse engineer songs through detailed tutorials and apps like Kapo that instantly reveal chords and keys. Photographers decode images by examining shadows, reflections, and distortion patterns that reveal camera techniques and lighting setups. The culinary world thrives on this approach. Todd Wilbur built his top secret recipes empire by meticulously recreating popular foods like Mrs. Fields cookies and McDonald's Big Mac, transforming his kitchen into a laboratory where he tested countless iterations until matching the originals. What distinguishes successful entrepreneurs like Bezos, Cuban, and Branson isn't just creativity or drive, it's superior pattern recognition. They excel at connecting past successes with current market changes to identify profitable opportunities. By studying case studies like Chipotle, entrepreneurs develop mental databases of proven blueprints. Steve Ells's success came from a simple formula. Taking a product popular in one location, Bay Area Taquerias, and introducing it to a new market, Denver. Reverse engineering extends far beyond business into high-stakes domains. In 1944, when a B-29 superfortress made an emergency landing in Russia, Stalin's engineers meticulously disassembled it, cataloging every component to create the nearly identical 2-4 bomber within 3 years. In medicine, reverse engineering enables the creation of generic drugs through deformulation, breaking down medications into their chemical components. The automotive industry has fully embraced reverse engineering as competitive benchmarking, with companies providing subscription access to detailed teardowns of competitors' vehicles. Many creative professionals fear that studying others' work too closely will lead to imitation rather than originality. This view fundamentally misunderstands creativity, which thrives on exposure to diverse ideas rather than isolation. Far from limiting creativity, reverse engineering expands our capabilities by helping us acquire new skills that empower fresh creation. Algorithmic thinking reveals how pattern recognition, the human brain's natural specialty, can be systematically applied to reverse engineer excellence. While humans excel at simple pattern recognition, algorithms outperform us with complex variables. IBM's Chef Watson exemplifies this by analyzing thousands of recipes and food science data to uncover hidden culinary principles. Watson revealed two critical insights. First, that aroma, not taste, primarily drives our enjoyment of food. And second, that aroma follows mathematical patterns. The most beloved dishes, like pizza, contain ingredients sharing numerous aromatic compounds. Tomatoes, mozzarella, parmesan, and baked wheat share over 100. Many creative masters begin as collectors. Andy Warhol collected artwork, David Bowie collected records, Julia Child collected cookbooks, and Quentin Tarantino watched thousands of films while working at a video store. Ernest Hemingway's personal library exceeded 9,000 books, growing by nearly 200 titles yearly, supporting Saul Bellow's observation that a writer is a reader who is moved to emulation. This collecting habit serves multiple purposes. It helps recognize mastery in others, refines taste, enables implicit learning of patterns without conscious effort, expands notions of what's possible, and illuminates the unique contributions of different influences. The more examples you gather, the more easily you can detect underlying patterns that make work exceptional. When encountering compelling examples, disruptive innovators don't merely appreciate them, they systematically question what makes them effective. Clayton Christensen's research reveals that what separates innovators like Musk, Hastings, and Bezos from ordinary managers isn't personality, but behavior, specifically their questioning habits. While managers comply, founders question everything. What's the real problem here? What would happen if we stopped accepting cash? Sometimes detecting patterns requires stepping back to see the whole picture, a technique called zooming out. In the 1950s, Wellington Mara revolutionized football strategy by taking Polaroid photos of opposing teams' formations from high in the stands, revealing patterns invisible from field level. Similarly, reverse outlining helps uncover the hidden structure in excellent writing by distilling each paragraph to its essence. Just as doctors use vital signs to standardize patient assessment, quantifying creative works helps detect patterns that distinguish excellence from mediocrity. Data scientists have identified specific features of hit songs, danceable with happy lyrics, blockbuster films, broadcast, minimal vulgarity, compelling nemesis, and best-selling novels, short opening sentences, few adverbs, middle school reading level. You don't need sophisticated statistics to apply this approach, simply quantify features of works you admire. Metrics unveil the strategic thinking behind successful businesses like Apple, whose website deliberately employs fewer words, focuses on emotional benefits over technical features, and maintains a museum-like stillness compared to Samsung's mall-like stimulation. Apple's approach, using poetic language like magic like you've never heard before, instead of technical specifications, reveals their emotional rather than logical appeal. By quantifying these differences, we can reverse engineer the thought processes behind successful designs and benchmark our own creations against industry leaders. Even Malcolm Gladwell began by trying to write like William F. Buckley before developing his own distinctive style. Simply copying formulas rarely succeeds because exceptional work depends on more than just recipes. It requires the right combination of formula, person, and context. Audiences evolve after exposure to novel experiences, which is why musicians like David Bowie constantly reinvent themselves to stay relevant, while businesses must innovate rather than clone predecessors. Contrary to popular belief, audiences often reject highly creative ideas. Jennifer Mueller's research shows that novel ideas make people uncomfortable, with studies revealing we not only dismiss creative suggestions, but penalize those proposing them. This explains why our favorite songs rarely feature truly novel elements. Radiohead's experience with their experimental album Kid A demonstrates this principle. Their deliberate rejection of their successful rock formula for electronic experimentation was met with critical disdain and fan confusion, with their 1990s music still generating more sales decades later. Harvard researchers studying grant proposals discovered a sweet spot for winning ideas. Those containing just a small dose of novelty were most likely to receive funding. This finding aligns with Mad Men character Don Draper's insight that what audiences truly want is something derivative with a twist. Familiar enough to feel comfortable, but with just enough novelty to feel fresh. Harvard professor Kareem Lakhani calls this optimal newness, suggesting that the pressure to create something entirely original is counterproductive. Reverse engineering provides the formula. Your unique variation completes it. One approach is combining influences, as Quentin Tarantino did by injecting elements from less popular genres into dialogue-driven capers. The Doors created their iconic Light My Fire by blending Latin rhythms, jazz solos, and Bach-inspired introductions. In business, Steve Jobs combined MP3 players with cell phones to create the iPhone, while Google applied academic citation methods to web organization. As Matt Ridley puts it, creativity is what happens when ideas have sex. Marvel's billion-dollar franchise demonstrates how to keep a formula fresh by introducing directors from outside the superhero genre. This inexperienced experience approach brings fresh perspectives while maintaining core elements. For individuals, this means strategically expanding your network to include diverse influences. Even without direct access to influential figures, simply asking how would person approach this can shift your mindset dramatically. Strategic ignorance, being deliberately selective about what influences you consume, is crucial for creative differentiation. When everyone in a field reads the same books and follows the same trends, originality becomes nearly impossible. Many successful creators practice this discipline. Tom Petty avoided Bruce Springsteen's music to prevent intensifying their similarities. Eddie Van Halen stopped listening to contemporary music entirely. Bill Maher and Jimmy Fallon deliberately ignore other news-based comedians. Sometimes the most compelling innovations emerge accidentally from perceived limitations. Amy Winehouse and Mark Ronson weren't trying to be original. They were attempting to recreate 1960s Motown sounds. Their failure to perfectly replicate that style, with Ronson adding hip-hop beats and Winehouse contributing somber lyrics, created something uniquely powerful. True innovation often comes not from perfect mimicry, but from how we uniquely adapt existing formulas through our own limitations and strengths. The gap between vision and ability can be debilitating, especially when you have high standards. Ira Glass describes this phenomenon perfectly. Beginners get into creative work because they have good taste, but their early work disappoints them because it doesn't match their vision. Many never get past this phase and quit. This divide never truly disappears. Even accomplished novelist Ann Patchett experiences it with each new book. For Patchett, writing involves three phases: plotting, blissful, full of promise; procrastinating, resisting the grueling journey ahead; and producing, when soul-crushing disappointment arrives. She vividly describes how the beautiful butterfly of her idea gets crushed when attempting to capture it on the page. Both Glass and Patchett agree that having a clear vision creates not just disappointment, but risk of quitting. However, this sensitivity to quality is actually valuable. Good taste is harder to develop than skill. Whether taste comes from genetics, economics, as Pierre Bourdieu argued, or psychological needs, as Alain de Botton suggests, developing awareness of what moves you is essential for producing extraordinary work. As Jonathan Safran Foer notes, great writers distinguish themselves through taste, knowing what they personally respond to. Rather than lamenting our inability to perform at a high level immediately, we should celebrate our ability to recognize when improvements are needed. Science fiction writer Theodore Sturgeon, tired of critics dismissing his genre as juvenile trash, made a provocative declaration in 1958: 90% of everything is crud. This Sturgeon's law suggests that within any field, most production is forgettable. While 90% may be arbitrary, it provides a useful benchmark. If half of everything you encounter seems spectacular, your taste likely isn't sufficiently developed. The vision ability gap should sting. Properly harnessed, this discomfort provides motivational fuel for improvement. The Ritz-Carlton's exceptional service stems from training employees to address unexpressed needs behind guest questions. Rather than giving factually correct but basic responses like, "Yes, it does," to "Does the hotel have a coffee shop?", employees offer solutions to underlying challenges. "Yes, it does. Would you like me to text you the menu?" This approach generates sky-high Net Promoter Scores and consistently places the Ritz-Carlton atop luxury hotel rankings, demonstrating how focusing on a specific metric can drive extraordinary outcomes. Measurement inherently drives improvement. When a metric is introduced, we instinctively pay more attention and optimize for it. This principle works for both businesses and individuals. Food diaries double dieters' weight loss by forcing reflection on consumption patterns. Time tracking helps professionals identify wasted effort and poor choices. Metrics introduce emotional dimensions to progress. Seeing numbers rise generates satisfaction and pride, while watching them fall creates disappointment that motivates improvement. Our fascination with metrics is deeply rooted in human psychology. Video games expertly leverage this by displaying scores that make games more entertaining and competitive, as demonstrated by Greg Irway, who played the arcade game Tapper for 16 hours straight without food or bathroom breaks just to achieve a world record score. This obsession with numbers may satisfy our basic psychological need for competence or represent what researcher Andreas Nieder calls our evolutionary numbers instinct, an ancient survival mechanism. Our evolutionary craving for numerical information presents both opportunity and danger. We're now bombarded with metrics, but many are what Eric Ries calls vanity metrics, figures that excite non-experts but don't reflect true success. For startups, these include website visitors instead of conversions, total users instead of paying customers, and user growth instead of active users. The opportunity lies in measuring the right actions, those that bridge the gap between vision and current ability. By 2016, Roger Federer's tennis career appeared to be ending. After dominating for nearly two decades, his performance had declined. After knee surgery and a brief, ill-advised comeback attempt, he took 6 full months to recover, not just physically rehabilitating, but methodically analyzing his game. The metrics revealed his weakness, his backhand. When Federer returned in 2017, he stunned everyone by winning the Australian Open against Nadal, hitting 14 backhand winners, a 350% improvement. He'd transformed his greatest weakness by taking his backhand earlier, swinging with more power, and hitting flatter with less spin. Federer's comeback reveals how breaking down complex performance into distinct, measurable components can yield game-changing insights. Three approaches can help design effective metrics. First, break activities into subskills, like separating a pitch into memorization, delivery, body language, and poise. Second, identify key features of successful outcomes, like elements of an effective client email. Third, take a holistic approach by evaluating your overall performance across time periods. To create effective personal scoreboards, follow three best practices. First, collect multiple metrics rather than focusing on a single number. Second, aim for balance in your metrics. Track both behaviors and outcomes to identify leading indicators, measure both short-term and long-term outcomes to maintain motivation, and monitor both desirable and undesirable metrics. Finally, evolve your metrics periodically instead of following an outdated formula. As skills improve, what's worth tracking changes. While growth requires strain and moderate difficulty as essential for development, the workplace presents unique challenges to learning. Unlike sports or education, where experimentation is valued, work environments demand instant results and punish mistakes. Organizations optimize for efficiency rather than employee growth, requiring repetitive tasks that limit learning opportunities. Even when workers identify worthwhile risks, they lack the immediate feedback that athletes receive. Political candidates use low-stakes speeches at senior centers, diners, and VFW halls to discover winning phrases and resonant themes. This approach of gathering feedback from small audiences extends across professions. Scott Adams transformed Dilbert by including his email in comic strips and discovering readers' most enjoyed workplace scenarios. Liz Winstead pretests comedy material on Twitter, using likes and retweets to identify winning jokes. Jeff Kinney found success with Diary of a Wimpy Kid after testing his cartoons on FunBrain, a kids' education website. Using pseudonyms is another powerful approach to minimizing risk. The Rolling Stones performed as the Cockroaches in small venues to practice without the pressure of perfection. In business, The Gap uses sub-brands like Old Navy, Banana Republic, and Athleta to target different audiences while protecting its core brand from failed experiments. Retailers employ private labels. Target manages 36 of them, creating the appearance of variety while minimizing risk. Nick Swinmurn's sell-first, procure-second approach has a long history in business. Bill Gates used this strategy as a Harvard sophomore when he saw the Altair 8800 in popular electronics. Rather than developing software first, Gates wrote to the manufacturer claiming his team had already built compatible software, then called to arrange a presentation. Only after securing the meeting did he and Paul Allen begin developing BASIC, which became Microsoft's foundation. This approach, pre-selling before creating, helps creators confirm market interest before investing in execution. The venture capital approach to risk management originated in 19th century whaling, where investors spread funds across multiple ships to mitigate against total loss. This diversification strategy drives today's successful conglomerates like Disney and Berkshire Hathaway. Linda Weinman exemplifies this principle in individual careers. She transformed from a Hollywood special effects animator to creating Lynda.com, sold to LinkedIn for $1.5 billion, by diversifying her offerings from teaching classes to writing textbooks, holding seminars, and creating online content. Tony Romo, whose NFL career was largely considered underwhelming, stunned viewers with his uncanny ability to predict plays as a broadcaster. His Romo-Stradamus abilities, correctly forecasting plays 68% of the time, aren't supernatural, but represent expertise in action. Brain scans would reveal three key differences between experts like Romo and novices. Experts use less brain energy by focusing only on relevant cues. They consider fewer options by eliminating unlikely scenarios, and their brains physically adapt through neuroplasticity, with certain regions becoming more developed. Self-reflection dramatically improves performance, as Harvard researchers demonstrated with their matrix exercise. Participants who took 3 minutes to reflect on their strategies outperformed those who merely took a break, solving 20% more puzzles. This reflective practice offers multiple benefits. It prompts us to pause and evaluate our progress, facilitates deeper learning by revealing higher-order principles and shortcuts, and stimulates insight by comparing experiences against prior beliefs. One powerful method of reflective practice is journaling, a technique used by top performers like Thomas Edison, Frida Kahlo, and Serena Williams. Despite its reputation, journaling offers the high ground perspective that even Navy SEALs value in battle. Writing by hand forces us to slow down and process our thoughts more deeply, yielding profound insights while reducing anxiety and stress. The 5-year journal format is particularly valuable, allowing users to compare entries from the same date across multiple years, revealing patterns and growth. Elite athletes like Michael Phelps, Lindsey Vonn, and Pelé use mental imagery as a crucial performance tool. Phelps would visualize his entire swim routine before bed. Vonn simulated breathing patterns while imagining downhill runs, and Pelé used visualization to recapture childhood joy and replay his greatest moments. This practice extends beyond sports. Surgeons who mentally rehearse procedures make fewer errors. Musicians learn compositions faster, and public speakers deliver more compelling presentations. While success stories like Bianca Andreescu writing herself a $3.5 million check before winning the U.S. Open suggest visualization creates success, research proves otherwise. UCLA researchers divided psychology students into three groups before their midterm. One visualized receiving high grades, another visualized the studying process, and a control group tracked study time. Surprisingly, those who visualized success performed worst of all groups. The emotional satisfaction from imagining success actually diminishes our motivation to do the necessary work. Meanwhile, visualizing the process led to more studying, lower anxiety, and higher grades. Process visualization offers five key benefits. It helps identify obstacles before encountering them, provides an emotional preview of likely reactions, enables front-loading decisions, builds confidence through mental rehearsal, and activates the same neural pathways as actual performance. Studies show athletes using imagery can cut physical practice in half without performance decline. Baseball's traditional batting practice represents coaching malpractice that actively hinders performance. Players face slow, straight-line pitches from coaches that bear no resemblance to the 90-mile-per-hour spinning pitches they'll face in games. This illustrates how practice can sabotage skill development when it fails to replicate real conditions or address actual challenges. Elite performers like Dan Knights, the Rubik's Cube world champion, use extreme practice conditions to maintain growth. Knights practiced while skydiving and leaning out of moving cars, examples of pressure acclimatization training that creates more anxiety than real performances. In 2001, Hollywood's elite gathered for a rare 10-day acting seminar with Marlon Brando, the actor of the century. DiCaprio, Penn, Williams, and others anticipated revelations from the method acting pioneer. Instead, they witnessed Brando's bizarre entrance in drag, followed by days of watching Samoan wrestlers, homeless people attempting to act, and receiving harsh, abrupt criticism. By day three, many walked out, calling it a circus. This disaster illustrates a crucial insight. Experts rarely make great teachers. We wrongly assume top performers understand and can articulate what makes them exceptional. Sports history proves otherwise. Magic Johnson, Isaiah Thomas, and Wayne Gretzky all failed as coaches despite legendary playing careers. Similarly, academic research shows virtually zero correlation between professors' research output and teaching effectiveness. Jimmy Fallon's charades game with Gal Gadot on The Tonight Show perfectly illustrates the curse of knowledge, when knowing something makes it impossible to imagine not knowing it. Despite Gadot's confidence in her clues for Born to Run, Fallon couldn't decipher her gestures. A Stanford study confirms this phenomenon. Tappers expected listeners to recognize 50% of tapped songs, but the actual success rate was only 2.5%. Our brains evolved to acquire information, not discard it, making it neurologically impossible to simulate not knowing. Experts struggle to teach effectively because most of their actions occur unconsciously. Richard Clark's cognitive task analysis reveals that experts typically omit 70% of the steps required for success in their instructions. When experts do focus on normally automatic behaviors, their performance often deteriorates, a phenomenon known as choking. Research with golfers demonstrates this paradox. Experienced players performed worse after analyzing their technique, while novices improved. When a rare opportunity arises to speak with an expert, three types of questions can help bypass the curse of knowledge. Journey questions like, "What mistakes did you make at the beginning?" help uncover their path from novice to master while reminding them of their early struggles. Process questions focus on specific execution steps. What do you do first? What's next? Discovery questions like, "What was most surprising?" or "What do you wish you had known?" reveal unexpected insights they gained along the way. We live in a feedback-saturated world, yet much of this feedback proves unhelpful or even harmful. In person, people often avoid honest criticism to maintain relationships. Online, provocative reviews attract more attention, incentivizing critics to be clever rather than helpful. Most alarmingly, research published in Psychological Bulletin found that in over one-third of cases, feedback actively damaged performance rather than improving it. Effective feedback requires specificity and should prioritize improvement over assessment. When seeking input, avoid validation-seeking questions like, "Do you like it?" and instead ask targeted questions about specific elements. Ironically, asking for advice rather than feedback yields better results. Harvard research shows advice-seeking generates 50% more improvement ideas by orienting reviewers toward future possibilities rather than past performance. Our natural aversion to criticism stems from how negative feedback triggers cortisol release, elevating anxiety and disrupting focus. Top performers overcome this by translating criticism into specific corrective actions, which neurological research shows activates the brain's reward centers rather than pain centers. Research at Columbia University and the University of Chicago reveals that while beginners prefer positive feedback, experts actively seek negative feedback because they recognize it contains vital clues for improvement. Vincent van Gogh's transformation from a directionless young man with no artistic training to one of history's most influential painters illustrates the core principles of decoding greatness. Despite having no childhood interest in art and failing at multiple professions, Van Gogh achieved mastery in just 10 years through techniques explored throughout this book. Identifying models to deconstruct, analyzing works across diverse genres, combining distinct elements from disparate influences, experimenting relentlessly, and practicing at the edge of his abilities. His evolution wasn't the result of innate talent, but of collecting works he admired, identifying their crucial features, recreating them, and then evolving them by combining influences and taking intelligent risks. Van Gogh's journey demonstrates that greatness isn't reserved for the naturally gifted. It's available to anyone who applies these principles deliberately. The book's 10 essential lessons provide a roadmap for achieving greatness in any field. 1. Become a collector of outstanding examples in your field. 2. Spot what makes exceptional work different. 3. Think in blueprints by working backward from finished products. 4. Don't mimic but evolve formulas by adding new influences. 5. Embrace the vision ability gap, the disconnect between your taste and current abilities. 6. Keep score selectively on metrics that drive success. 7. Take the risk out of risk-taking through small experiments. 8. Distrust comfort as a signal that development has stalled. 9. Harness both reflective practice and mental imagery. And 10. Ask experts strategic questions that reveal their journey and process. We live in an age of unparalleled creative abundance, with ingredients readily available. Having learned to unlock, master, and evolve these ingredients in new directions, it's time to see what you can do.